Welcome to this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. This Sunday marks the beginning of the end for Mad Men when AMC airs the first episode of the series' final season. The acclaimed drama, which depicts the martini-fueled, sex-filled lives of advertising executives in the 1960s, can raise questions about its historical accuracy. Did they really live like that? We got the answer on Radio Times when we were joined by Jane Moss, author of Mad Women, The Other Side of Life on Madison Avenue in the 60s and Beyond. She spent her younger years working for the high-powered New York advertising agency Ogilvy & Mather, where she was privy to just as much drinking, sex, and drama that has made Mad Men one of the most compelling shows on TV. Let's listen to my interview with Jane Moss from 2012. Well, let's begin with a question that you're always asked, but we'll get it over with, and then we'll talk
right.
about your book.
I think I know what it's going to be.
I think
right?
you do as well. So, looking at Mad Men, fact, fiction, a mix of the two?
They get a lot of things absolutely right. People say to me all the time, were women really discriminated against that way? Is Mad Men accurate about three martini lunches and all that drinking? And then they lean forward and say, was there all that sex in the office?
Exactly.
And I say the answer to all three is yes, absolutely, unequivocally, yes, all of that was going on.
And it sounded like you were a woman, the sole or only woman in a lot of meetings at that time.
Yes. Well, of course, there were a number of women copywriters at Ogilvy because we had a number of women's accounts, the kind of accounts that women copywriters were allowed to work on, detergents and toilet bowl cleaners. And we were not allowed to work on accounts like automobiles because men thought we didn't know how to drive. And we weren't allowed to work on anything financial because they figured we didn't know how to balance our checkbooks. And, of course, we couldn't work on liquor because that's what they used to seduce us. So we obviously didn't understand drinking either.
Well, speaking of liquor, and again, this is the TV show, but I also have to say reading in your book as well, the three martini lunch is not a piece of fiction, that there was serious drinking going on at lunchtime, and it sounds like might spill into the afternoon and certainly after work as well.
Well, one of the complaints I hear from friends in the advertising business who were active in the 60s is that Mad Men exaggerates the drinking. An account executive I knew at Ogilvy in the 60s said, we never drank in the morning. But the three martini lunch is absolutely real. I interviewed a copywriter who had worked for me at Ogilvy, and she said that when she was at Young and Rubicam, which is supposed to be the agency on which Sterling Cooper of Mad Men is based, and Young and Rubicam was said to be the hotbed of sex in the 60s. But when she was at Young and Rubicam, her boss often took her out for lunch, and she said, we would start with martinis. He'd have three, and I'd have two. And then we would end our lunch with rusty nails, which is a lethal combination of scotch and drambuie. And I said, Linda, how did you get up and go back to work then?
Exactly.
And she said, I think what saved us is we didn't have wine. Right.
But I think that's a real question, which is how do you go back to work and even function after you've had three martinis and some rusty nails?
Well, I think men went out to lunch every day, as I remember it, Marty. Women didn't go to lunch every day. One was we knew that somebody had to stay back in the office and get the work done. And two, I think it was a form of calorie control. So we knew we couldn't just keep pouring all that amount of liquor down our throats all the time.
So does that mean that the women, certainly in the afternoon, were doing the lion's share of the work?
I think so. A lot of the men, the senior men, came and took little snoozes on the couches in their office, as we see Don Draper quite often doing. And Jerry Della Femina, a famous advertising man, when I asked him the question about how did you guys go back to work, he said what saved us is our clients had just as much to drink at lunch as we did,
and they didn't know
we were so tipsy.
So did you do the three martini lunch, or were you more likely to stay back at work?
I was much more likely to stay back at work, and I don't mean to be goody-goody about it. I was very ambitious, and I was very eager to make my mark, and I'm only 5 feet tall, and it doesn't take much to make me a little tipsy, so I think I knew that I really couldn't do that.
Well, one of the things that is so almost shocking in Mad Men is the clothing that the women wear, the very pointed bras. Looks like they've been poured into some of those very tight outfits. Bras and girdles, an occupational hazard for you back at that time?
We all had to wear layers and layers. The bras were quite painful. They bit into your shoulders and other parts of you. Remember, pantyhose had not yet been invented. We had to wear stockings with seams and little garter belts. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the next layer was a slip, which was absolutely obligatory. And then the costume that you wore to the office was either a dress, the kind that Joan wears with this very cinched-in waist and very tight bodice, or you wore a suit, the kind that Peggy very often wears with a tailored blouse. And, of course, you wore high heels all day long. If I were casting for a commercial for a housewife who was scrubbing her floor, she would scrub the floor in a skirt and blouse and
Absolutely.
High heels.
We're dishing here, and your book clearly dishes on the ad world of the 60s and even into the 70s. But I also get the feeling that you really loved your job. You loved working as a copywriter and all the other jobs you've had in advertising.
Marty, thank you for picking that up from the book, because I did love my job. I loved my career. Advertising was very good to me and very enriching. I think one of the things that Mad Men doesn't get is the passion that we had in that era for creating fresh, exciting, new advertising, and how much we liked and respected each other, the people that we were working with. And it was fun. It was just fun.
And do you think that was unusual at that time, or that perhaps, unlike Mad Men, it was more collaborative and cooperative?
I think it was more collaborative. There were certainly people were ambitious. People were trying to climb the ladder to the top. But I don't think there was as much aggressiveness in pushing a fellow worker under the bus as there is in Mad Men. But I keep reminding myself, Mad Men is a drama, and they need to have a certain amount of tension going on. So,
you were a working woman at this time. Did other women look down on you, do you think?
Well, a woman with children under the age of 12 simply did not work in those days. When my older daughter was in first grade, there were only two full-time working mothers. The other women thought we were a little weird and would say to us, "What do you do when they're sick?" You know, with some disdain. And men, of course, pitied us because they figured we had to be married to bums. Otherwise, why were we working? It just simply wasn't done.
Let me go back to, and not just Mad Men, but also in your book, you talk about the office affairs. Clearly, in the TV show, we see many office affairs, and I got the feeling from your book that it was relatively common to have office affairs.
Well, people said in the 60s that sex was in the air. People breathed it, I was told. When I began to interview people for the book, I think part of it was the pill had just been was just made available in 1960, and that probably increased the freedom of people to have sex. The women's movement and feminism was beginning to take hold, particularly among creative people, and also, we were all working very, very hard, and when you're thrown together, and people were thrown together a lot, and the most senior men who were giving their lives, really, to the agencies they worked for, and they were the ones who were there early in the morning and stayed until late at night, and by the time they got home, their wives were asleep, and so it was very, very tempting for them, I think, to begin to have affairs, romances with the sweet young things, the attractive young, sexy young women at the office.
Well, you even say, and I guess with a senior executive, they could afford to have an apartment in the city, and if they were working long hours or even a hotel room in the city, that was a place where they could go.
You bet. And here's another thing. They had offices with doors that locked, and they had couches. The younger account executives weren't allowed to have couches. They only had chairs. When you got promoted to vice president as a mark of your promotion at Ogilvy, you got a couch.
And where you worked, did everyone know who was having an affair with somebody else and you just looked the other way?
Most of the time, everybody knew sooner or later, but everyone was very discreet. Mm. I was told by some of the folks at Young and Rubicam that there was a hotel right around the corner, and the desk clerks didn't bat an eye or raise their eyebrows if you asked for a key at 12 noon and returned it at 2. And they said, and if you met fellow agency people in the lobby as you were coming out, you just averted your eyes and didn't say hello.
You also tell a story about, an office where there was some sexual activity going on, and the door was open.
There was no door.
The
couple thought that they were alone, except the big boss was. He was an account executive, and she was a secretary, and they were having a little sex in the office. And the boss, on his way out, discovered them. And the upshot was that he was given a promotion and an office with a door, and the secretary was fired. Mm. And that's what very often happened, that somebody had to be punished as far as the agency was concerned if the sex were blatant, and it was usually the woman.
And as someone that worked in those kinds of offices in those days, was that just a given, or did people feel as if that was unfair? And, you know, why was he promoted and she was kicked out the door?
Well, Marty, I think, unfortunately, a lot of women accepted this as a given. That's the way things were. That was the status quo. A woman copywriter told me that she went to her boss and complained that the copywriter sitting in the next office to her was making twice what she was. And she said, "And I think I'm writing just as good advertising and probably better, and I would like to make as much as he's making." And her boss said, but he's a man. He has a wife and kids to support. And she said, I didn't think of that, and dropped the matter and didn't bring it up again.
It sounds a lot like Peggy Olson.
Well, yes, I think she has been very accepting of a lot of demeaning stuff.
Again, that was my interview with Jane Moss, who joined me in 2012 to discuss her book, Mad Women, The Other Side of Life on Madison Avenue in the 1960s and Beyond. When we get back from this break, we'll listen to my conversation about Leonardo da Vinci's painting, The Last Supper. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. In honor of Good Friday, we'll now turn to my conversation with Ross King, who detailed the fascinating story behind one of the most famous paintings in history, Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper. The 15th century painting depicts Jesus Christ and his apostles on the day before he was crucified. Da Vinci is considered a true genius today. He was not viewed that way during his lifetime. In fact, he was a somewhat unlikely choice for this project. Let's listen to my 2012 interview with Ross King, author of Leonardo and the Last Supper. Do you think of this as a masterpiece?
I do. I think if the Last Supper isn't a masterpiece, that raises the bar very high for what possibly could be.
It seems as if Leonardo da Vinci was, if not an odd, a risky choice to paint the Last Supper.
That's right. I think we tend to look at Leonardo, with some good reason, as a polymath genius who could succeed at anything that he turned his hand to. And yet, he did have one very conspicuous weakness when it came to painting. One, that he didn't know how to paint in fresco, which is usually the way you would paint if you were asked to paint a wall of revolt. And then secondly, and maybe even more damagingly, he didn't really like to paint that much. It was not his first career choice, shall we say.
Well, and didn't finish projects that he started.
That's right. He left Florence for Milan in 1482 when he was 30 years old, and he left smoldering behind him in the city where he'd lived for the previous 15 years and done his apprenticeship a series of paintings, altarpieces for patrons that he had failed to deliver.
Well, and just to add to that, he also was considered, I guess, old by those standards. He was in his 40s.
That's right. When he got the Last Supper commission in 1494, he was 42 years old, which doesn't seem particularly old to me, and I'm sure many of the listeners. And yet, the average life expectancy for a man in 15th century Italy was 40. So in some ways, Leonardo had lived the full span of years that he could have been expected to live without achieving a masterpiece, what he called a work of fame. And he wanted to create a work of fame. He wanted to make his name immortal down the centuries and to step up onto the pantheon of great Italian artists, sculptors, architects of the 14th and 15th century. But he had not yet, if he died at 42, we wouldn't be talking about him today. And he would be a footnote in the history of art, someone who had great promise, did a number of wonderful things, but didn't do a lot of other wonderful things because he left them on the drawing board.
Well, as you describe Leonardo, that he looked like a man or sounded like a man of great charisma, also very good looking, beautiful,
right,
as some described.
That's right. Leonardo seems to have been, among so many other wonderful things, a true gentleman, the perfect courtier, which is one of the reasons why he succeeded at the court of Lodovico Sforza. Everyone seemed to like him. Everyone who met him instantly recognized that he was something very special, that he had extraordinary talents. But on top of those talents, he seems to have had an ability to get along with people. Unlike his younger contemporary, Michelangelo, who was a thoroughly surly, temperamental, and just plain old grumpy, paranoid character, Leonardo seems to have been much more pleasant and would have been a wonderful dinner party companion.
Was Leonardo religious?
Not conventionally. He was probably no better or no worse a Christian than many people in Italy at that time. He certainly wasn't pious like Michelangelo, who, especially towards the end of his life, was extremely devout. Leonardo was not a heretic, as is sometimes said. In fact, the first claim for him being a heretic dates from 1550. It's only a couple of decades after his death. Was he an atheist? It's difficult to know. It's difficult to know if anyone was at that time. In some ways, that was not a belief option. That didn't really enter the horizon of possibility. He was anti-clerical. There's no doubt about that.
Meaning he criticized the clerics?
He criticized the monks, the priests. He thought there was a certain amount of ecclesiastical corruption. And A, he was absolutely right that there was, and B, many other people said exactly the same thing. However, he does make a number of references to God in his writings, and also in particular with his work on anatomy, which he really began in about 1510, 1511. And it seems that his study of anatomy awakened his wonder for a creator, and he makes statements which sound pious, and they may be somewhat conventional pieties, but he does say that we must praise man as the most wonderful machine, and therefore we must praise the creator of this wonderful object.
Well, even before Leonardo began to work on this, there were other paintings of the Last Supper.
That's right. The analogy that someone used to me when I was discussing earlier Last Suppers is that lots of people had recorded blue suede shoes before Elvis Presley, but then he became the ultimate, the standard of it. And that's the way the Last Supper really has been, because it was something that was done often in cycles of frescoes showing scenes from the life of Christ or showing the Passion, because, of course, it's a central moment in the Passion of Christ. But also it then was something that detached from these lives of Christ and became a stand-alone scene in refectories, in convents, monasteries, in other words, cafeterias, places where the nuns, friars, monks would gather together to break bread, to eat together, because the refectory is a consecrated space where they eat together in silence, apart from the lector in mensa, the reader of the table. And often the art on the wall, excuse me, had a thematic link to the function of the room. And so showing a dining scene, as Andy Warhol called The Last Supper, he called it Leonardo's dining scene, having a dining scene in a cafeteria obviously makes that thematic link fairly logically and clearly.
You have some wonderful descriptions of Leonardo, walking the streets of Milan, sketching, looking at faces, being particularly interested in things like noses, for instance.
That's right. Leonardo was fascinated by facial features and what a face could tell us about the personality or the person behind it. And yes, he divided noses into 10 different types. So you can figure out what kind of nose you have. And he did go through one of the stories, which is fairly credible, has him going to the poor area of Milan every night for about a year looking for someone whose features will match Judas. I'm not sure why he had to go to the poor area to find that. He could have looked around the court of Lodovico Sforza and found some villainous-looking characters. Nevertheless, the story is that he went to this poor area just outside the wall looking for someone whose features would be adequate to convey the depth of evil that he saw in the betrayer of Christ.
Well, you say he possibly, probably even used himself as a model for two people who appear in The Last Supper.
That's right.
Thomas.
Doubting Thomas, who is, as we look at the painting, to the right of Christ, the one sticking his finger in the air, and then the one second from the left, James the Lesser. The reason I argue this, and it is, I put it out there somewhat speculatively, but in 1498, the year that Leonardo finished The Last Supper, a poet in Milan who knew Leonardo and whose poems Leonardo owned wrote a kind of lampoon of a painter saying that he put his handsome features and also his actions and ways in his painting. And it seems to me, and not just to me, but very reputable Leonardo scholars, that he's talking about Leonardo. But because these are reputable Leonardo scholars, they don't feel the need to speculate about who this might have been or what particular painting. It seems to me most logical that it is The Last Supper. And we do know that he put lots of real people in the painting because someone who saw the work in the early part of the 16th century, shortly after it was done, said that when he looked at it, he saw not just Christ and the 12 apostles, but Milanese high society, a kind of who's who of Milan. And there were no more eminent personages than Leonardo himself.
And as you say, the gesture, I guess it's Doubting Thomas has his finger raised.
That's right.
Which was kind of a signature gesture of Leonardo.
That's right. Leonardo has the pointing finger in a number of his paintings, such as the Louvre Virgin of the Rocks, the painting of St. John the Baptist, the very last painting he did. And if you think about Doubting Thomas, if Leonardo were to represent himself as one of the apostles, Thomas is the natural choice because Leonardo is someone who didn't take anything on the authority of others. He wanted to see and think and probe and feel and touch for himself. And in essence, what Thomas does is he anatomizes the risen Christ. And Leonardo, of course, was an anatomist and wanted to put his hand inside bodies.
And who was the model for Jesus? Does anyone know?
Well, that's interesting because Leonardo's notes describe two people he's going to use for Christ. He says, Alessandro Carissimi da Parma for the hands of Christ. And the hands of Christ are obviously central to the painting, literally central to it. And the action of it all turns on the hands of Christ. And so Leonardo wanted a very expressive pair of hands, not just any pair would do. And so there was a young aristocrat in Milan, Alessandro, who he obviously got to know and decided that his hands were beautiful and expressive, and he would use them for the hands of Christ, which tells us something about the depth of research that Leonardo did for the painting and how deeply he thought of things like hands, small details like that. The face, though, is in some ways even more interesting because I'm sure your listeners can conjure to mind the face of Christ in The Last Supper, very peaceful, serene, beatific figure who is very calm in the midst of all of the tumult. And oddly enough, the man who posed for Christ was a soldier who fought in a number of very bloody battles and served for some fairly unscrupulous and unsavory warlords such as Cesare Borgia. His name was Giovanni Conte, and Leonardo states Giovanni Conte for the head of Christ. And so the Prince of Peace, by a strange kind of irony, ends up being posed by a man who I think probably literally had quite a lot of blood on his hands.
And that's Ross King, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his latest book called Leonardo and the Last Supper. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So let's get into one of the controversies, conspiracies even, about the Last Supper. And this is the figure of John. Some people, I guess most notably from the Da Vinci Code, believing that this was Mary Magdalene. You essentially take this down. Can you do that for us on the radio?
Right. Well, first of all, see chapter 12, The Beloved Disciple. That's the chapter where I discuss it, because, of course, you have to discuss it. And I'm glad you introduced him as John, because he is John, despite the appeal of the other story. I think Leonardo would have been perplexed by, and the Dominicans as well, mm-hmm. for whom Leonardo painted it, would have been perplexed by the story about Mary Magdalene. The reason I argue that it's John for a number of reasons, and in the heyday of the Da Vinci Code a number of years ago, I used to come to various groups and give a talk on the real Leonardo da Vinci and the art of the Da Vinci Code. And so I would give my spiel for about 45 minutes and show previous Last Suppers painted in earlier centuries, showing a very youthful, because John was the youngest of the apostles, a very youthful John with long hair. He was always beardless. Then I would discuss the relationship between Christ and St. John, that John was the beloved disciple, the one whom Christ loved most, was asleep on his bosom at the Last Supper. And I would show many images of John mm-hmm. and Christ together. John often as an adolescent, almost an androgynous adolescent. And then I would discuss the interest in androgyny in 15th century art and the way in which Donatello created what you almost might call she-males or something like his David, who is a very androgynous character, is Bronze David, very slender, almost female, and yet is supposed to be a male, and the fascination with hermaphrodites that they had in 15th century Florence. And I would talk about Leonardo and his fascination with his ideal of beauty was a young man who had somewhat feminine features and was on the cusp of masculinity, femininity, and the cusp of childhood or youth and adulthood, which was best represented for him by his young assistant and someone who stayed with him for the rest of his life, Salai, this very badly behaved young assistant he had.
But quite beautiful and cherubic looking, at least
right.
as a child.
As a child, very beautiful. Leonardo was bewitched by him. And because Salai represented this ideal of androgynous beauty. And so I would do all of this, and then at the very end I would show Mary Magdalene. I would show Leonardo paintings in which there were female-looking characters, which were clearly meant to be male. The very end of the lecture, I would put up this picture of John / Mary Magdalene and say, who still believes that this is Mary Magdalene? Every hand would go up. So I've given up believing that I can convince anyone otherwise.
And how soon after the Last Supper was finished did it begin to deteriorate?
Really, within his own lifetime. He died in 1519, and by the middle of the 15-teens, so a couple of years before he died, people are saying that the paint is beginning to flake off the wall. And that's because he did not find the magic ingredient. He was not, even with all of his ingenuity and his hours of grinding up oils and refining them, was he able to arrest mm-hmm. this decay of his paint from the wall. And within 100 years, by the 1580s, people talk of it as a total ruin.
Wow. But he was determined to use the oil because that's how he liked to work. He didn't know how to do it any other way,
that's
but
right.
He liked what you could do with an oil.
That's right. He had not trained in fresco, but he loved the possibility. He loved oil paint. He was one of the great practitioners of it. Oil painting was still a relatively new technology in Italy at this point. It had developed a generation or so before, and he really began taking it to new heights. And he loved working very slowly, building up his color, layer upon layer, glaze upon glaze, and then smudging the paint, smudging it with his fingertips even, and his thumbs, and his fingerprints can be found in some of his paintings. Mm. And so fresco, you needed to work extremely quickly. You could only do one layer of paint. You couldn't go back to it a day later, a week later, a month later. And so not only did he not know how to do fresco, but it was an uncongenial medium for him. And I think even if he had trained in it, he probably would not have chosen to do it.
And it is interesting to think at how it has survived, as you said, a door cut into the painting, the moisture on the wall, there were floods. It was used as a stable by Napoleon's soldiers. Milan was bombed during World War II, exposing some of the Last Supper.
That's right. The vault was actually blown off the refectory, and the right wall, as you face the painting, disappeared. And there are photographs documenting what happened, showing this wall standing, the Last Supper wall standing with a tarpaulin over it. And so it was exposed to the elements and miraculously was spared. And it's interesting that the word most often used to describe it in the 16th century, in the century after it was done, is miraculous. Everyone thought it was miraculous. And by that, they meant a number of things. It was miraculous that it was still there, but it was also a miraculous work of art that a man could do something like this. And C, it was also believed to have miraculous properties. And a number of Leonardo's paintings, something we've completely lost sight of today, a number of Leonardo's paintings were people prayed to them and people worshipped them, not necessarily because of Leonardo's reputation and not necessarily because of their aesthetic qualities, but because of the fact that, for example, his Virgin of the Rocks is a wonderful portrayal of the Virgin Mary, or his Madonna and Child with St. Anne, drawings of which he did showed St. Anne the protectress of Florence. And so people would pray to Leonardo's paintings at those times. And so it's miraculous on all sorts of levels, not least, as I say, because of the fact that it is thankfully still with us.
That was my 2012 interview with Ross King about Leonardo da Vinci and his famous painting, The Last Supper. When we get back from the break, we'll hear the inspiring life story of Nikki Johnson Houston. She went from living on the street to becoming a prominent Philadelphia tax attorney and continues to advocate on behalf of the homeless. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Most Philadelphians come face to face with homelessness every single day. And while some of us feel compelled to give a homeless person some loose change, the act can often feel empty, knowing that a few quarters will not solve this complex problem. The new app Donify is a service that connects people on the street to the nearest organization that provides for the homeless. The app's founder, Nikki Johnson Houston, created the platform based on firsthand experience. She lived on the streets with her family as a child and understands what struggling people need in order to pull themselves out of the cycle of poverty. She joined me in 2012 to tell us the story about her life. She went from homelessness to becoming one of Philadelphia's most prominent tax attorneys, with a stint as the City of Philadelphia's tax solicitor. Let's take a listen to Nikki Johnson Houston's tale of determination. Well, I want to talk about your life because you grew up in Detroit.
Yes, I did.
Your mom was a single mom.
She was.
And your family was poor.
We were very poor. I like to say that, unfortunately, I think I was born into a situation like a lot of people who live in the cities in this country. By the time I was 5 years old, two of my uncles had been brutally murdered on the streets of Detroit. My dad wasn't around. He left when I was about 2 years old. And, you know, my mother had drug and alcohol issues. And really the glue that held us together was my maternal grandmother, who worked as a domestic. She really grounded me. But when I was five, she was in a pretty terrible bus accident coming home from one of her jobs, and it disabled her. And so that really changed our family. And my grandmother got a small settlement, and she made the decision that she was going to get our family out of Detroit because she was really concerned for our safety. And that's actually how we moved to California.
And lived in San Diego area?
Originally, we lived in Central California by Santa Barbara, which is a lovely area but very expensive. The way we ended up getting to San Diego was even though we moved to California, my mom's issues came with us, unfortunately. And after a lot of conflict, she decided that she was going to move away from my grandmother and moved us down to San Diego. But she really didn't have a plan. And after about a month of being there, she met a man and he basically took all of our money. And we were living in a hotel, and then we went down to living in a motel to, if people were kind enough to let us sleep on a sofa or on a floor or loan us a car. And then we ran out of friends, and that's how we ended up on the streets.
And when you say your mom's issues, we're talking about her issues, her problems with drugs and alcohol?
Yes, drugs. Absolutely an alcoholic, drug problems. It made it very difficult for her to, you know, get up and go to work. She didn't consistently work, even though she was a very intelligent person. And I think that's the frustrating thing is my mom was talented, and a lot of the people that I grew up with were talented. But I think along the way, they lost the hope of what was possible for them, and they really got caught up. And so after that, we were on the streets, and we would stand in line and try to wait for a room in a shelter, a bed. And if they ran out of beds, then we didn't have any place to go for the night.
So where would you go?
Would you sleep? My mom would find a park bench, and she would sleep with her eyes open, and she would put one of us on each of her knee.
And how old were you at the time?
I was 9. It's just such a scary time being a child. You don't know what's going on, but you know it's not the way it's supposed to be. But out of that darkness came an opportunity, which was during the day, we didn't have any place to go. So the shelters were only available for us at night. So we would go to the library. And I like to say that the books became my friends and playmates. And I started reading about the bigger world, the larger world, reading about biographies of people who had been through difficult times and had made it out the other side. And it helped me to dream and to conceive of a better future, and I'll always be thankful for that.
Well, it's so interesting because here you were, I mean, your real life obviously so difficult, but here these books showing you another world.
Yes.
And what you believe that world was something that you could have.
Absolutely. I think I definitely, once I went to live with my grandmother, and what I will say about my mother is that she made a very selfless decision, that she realized that she couldn't keep us together as a family, and she decided to split us up. And I know that was very difficult for her, and she still has alcohol issues, but I'm very proud to say that she's been off drugs for about 25 years. So I'm thankful for that. But because we were split up as a family, the decision was made for me to go live with my disabled grandmother. My grandmother could only take one of us, and it was twofold. One, she was living in Section 8 housing for senior citizens, so she wasn't actually supposed to have any of us. And two, my brother had some behavioral issues, and I think because I was a girl, it's very dangerous being out on the streets. The decision was made to send me to my grandmother, and I remember getting off the – I was put on a Greyhound bus, and I remember getting off the Greyhound bus.
And you're about 9 years old at the time?
Yes. I just turned 10. I remember getting off the Greyhound bus. It's 11:45 at night. It's dark, and I see my grandmother waiting there for me. And I get off the bus, and she says to me, "You're fortunate enough to be born in a different America than the America I was born to." And she said, "You are fortunate enough to be born to the greatest generation of women that will have ever lived. What are you going to do with that?"
This is the first thing she said to you.
That's the first thing she said to me. And to give you a context for that is my grandmother worked her whole life as a domestic. She grew up in Mississippi under Jim Crow. She was the last of 14 kids. She had dreams of going to school, had saved money to go to college. And that money was taken away from her and given to her brother because she was told that it was a waste of money to educate a black girl. And she never forgot that. And she didn't want me to forget that. She wanted me to remember, no matter how bad my circumstances were, that I can make a better life for myself. And she made a challenge for me when I got off that bus, and it made me start thinking about what my life could be and what I could achieve.
What did your mother do when you're living with your grandmother, your brother is sent to foster care? What happened to your mom?
She actually ended up marrying my stepdad, who had been a volunteer at the soup kitchen that we were at, and that provided some level of stability for her. And again, I'm thankful for that. Mm-hmm. At one point, I was sent to go back and live with her for about a year, and it was a great year. But again, she wasn't very stable, and we ended up homeless again. So I was sent back to go live with my grandmother.
Sometimes it's said about children when they see that their parents are struggling or in trouble, that children feel a sense of responsibility or obligation to help them or perhaps even save them. As a little girl, did you feel that way about your mom?
Absolutely. And I felt like a burden. I felt like maybe if I wasn't there, you know, maybe she could have done better. One of the decisions that I made before I even went to live with my grandmother is I remember waking up in a motel and knowing it was the last day that we had money to be there and that we were going to have to check out. And I remember my mom being passed out and my little brother being there. And I said, I'm not going to live like this. When I'm an adult, I'm not going to live like this. And I pulled out a phone book and started calling places to see if they would take us. And some of them hung up on me because I was a little kid and they thought I was crank calling them. But then I found a place that was willing to take us.
So clearly you were a good student. You end up at St. Joseph's University, which is just outside of Philadelphia. This is your freshman year, and I'm sure full of all sorts of expectations about what college was going to offer. What happened?
St. Joe's was wonderful. It seemed like a dream. I got off the plane and it's leafy and gorgeous and small and private, and the people were lovely there. I think for me, I didn't understand what college would really be like. I think academically I was prepared, but I think emotionally I wasn't prepared to go into an environment where people were so different from me.
Culture shock of some sort.
I really had culture shock, and I didn't know how to ask for help. And I was homesick, and I was so far away from anything that I knew. I felt like everything about me wasn't right. I didn't have a winter coat. I didn't know not to wear right after Labor Day. I didn't sort of speak the language. And it wasn't because people weren't nice to me, because they were. But a lot of people didn't sort of know what my background was. A lot of it was my own poor decision making. I started not going to class. I felt like I wasn't good enough. I felt like I was a fraud and didn't deserve to be there, and that everybody could see that. And, you know, it's hard sort of not having that support, because there were a lot of affluent people there. And so their context of their life was very different than mine.
And you must have felt very different from them.
I did. I felt very different from them. But that was more of my own making. But I think that comes from being young and you get a little bit of maturity. And so all of those things led to me my first semester being put on academic probation. But instead of sort of spurring me on to do better, it almost froze me. And so I just couldn't get out of my own way. So I understand what that feels like for people. And I ended up being kicked out. So I'm in Philadelphia. I don't really know anybody, and I have to figure out what I'm going to do.
You end up being a nanny for a couple on the main line.
Yes. Deborah Levy and Donald Versoff. They were a lifesaver for me. My childhood dream had always been to be a lawyer. And I answered an ad for a live-in nanny and didn't really have a lot of experience. And they took a chance on me. And they just both happened to be lawyers. So what are the odds of that? And you know, I was in this difficult place in my life, but they were also people who helped me believe that I could do something great.
So why did you, or when did you want to be a lawyer? Is that something you've always wanted in your life?
I always wanted to be a lawyer. I guess growing up with my grandmother, I was watching black and white Perry Mason and then Matlock.
There you go.
And then Bill Cosby comes on with The Cosby Show, and there's Claire Huxtable, and I knew that was who I wanted to be.
But what's interesting is you go to Temple University Law School, not just for one degree. You have 3 degrees, a JD, an MBA, and a master's in tax law.
Yes.
You were, what, in a big hurry? You wanted to just get all this done at once?
That was not the plan originally. The plan originally was I went there to go to law school, and I was happy and thrilled to be there. But they gave me an opportunity. I'd always wanted to get an MBA. And during my second semester, they said, you know, we have this JD MBA program, and if you can do well enough on your GMATs, you can get your MBA for free. Right. You just have to pay your law school tuition. And I was like, fantastic. Whoa. So I took it. I took the GMAT cold, got a good enough score to be able to get into the MBA program. And then actually how I ended up doing the master's in tax at the same time was I would have run out of financial aid, and I would have graduated in the middle of the year. And so I took a couple of tax classes, and I ended up really liking tax. I know that's not something that most people would think is that exciting. And then I said, well, you know what? What about this? And I'm really grateful that I was able to do something that sort of was special and different. And I always like to say, not bad for a girl who failed out of college. It really is where – it's not where you start. It's really where you end.
You've said some very interesting things during this hour. You've also said some other things that I've read about that are they're equally as interesting, and some about poverty, some about possibilities. I mean, what I hear from your story is that while there were barriers, there were obstacles, there were problems you had to deal with, there always seemed to be this sense of a different life or a possibility somewhere.
Absolutely. I mean, I didn't necessarily know that things would turn out the way that they did. I mean, it's turned out better than I really could have imagined. But I knew what my life would look like if I didn't do something different. And I didn't know all of this would be the way it would be, but I knew it had to be better than how I grew up. And I was going to give it my best shot. I wasn't going to fail. I couldn't afford to fail. So even though I did fail out of college, I did believe that it was a possibility for me to go back. And it's one of the things that I talk about a lot when I go and speak to children, because it's actually something that I didn't realize at the time. It's actually something that happens on a fairly regular basis with kids who are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds, and they're going to school, but they don't have a lot of support, and there's a lot of family responsibilities that come along with that. So even when I was in school and working at night, I would send money to my mother and my stepdad, not always on a regular basis, but I would get a call saying I'm about to be put on the streets, and I would put hotels on my credit cards. And so that's the reality when you're coming from that disadvantaged background. And a lot of people have to stop school so they can work to support not only their parents, but sometimes younger siblings or cousins. Mm. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the social safety net, which my grandmother
raised me on food stamps.
She raised me on welfare, subsidized housing. So I needed those things. But the way the system is set up, it's supposed to be to help you as long as you need it. But since I've been 18 years old, and there have been times I didn't have a lot of money and was eating Top Ramen soup, I've been self-sufficient. And I like to say that the taxpayers invested in me, and that in an ideal world, that's the way it's supposed to work. It's not supposed to be generational. There's dignity and work, and you don't want to take that away from people, but you also need to balance that with helping people who need help.
Do you feel like a survivor?
A little bit, but you know, I'm not a victim. I'm not someone that I want anybody to feel sorry for. I think I'm a lucky person. I think I'm an accomplished person. I'm living the kind of life that I always wanted to live. So I'm thinking beyond that. I'm thinking about what the next thing is. And, you know, I don't know if I'll turn out to even be like a great person, but maybe one of the kids that I speak to or one of the adults that I speak to, maybe they'll go on to do something great. And that's good enough for me, because I'm living my dream of being a lawyer. That's really what I wanted for myself. And now that dream has expanded to advocacy.
That was my conversation with Nikki Johnson Houston, recorded in 2012. She recently created a new philanthropy app called Donify. And that wraps up this edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks so much for listening.